The scholarship that I'm about to do has been a drawing. It has been around for a very long time. The first book, so far as I know, that was actually published that actually used the term emerging church was written in 1970 by Osborne and Larson. It's on your bibliography. Almost as an antique. I'm not suggesting that you read it, but you'll see that that thing's annotated, and you'll find it there. It's interesting. It's almost scary. It's so prescient. And they were the first, so far as I know, to talk about emerging church in this country. Emerging church, though, is visible, or emergence Christianity, is visible from does the Word of God or Word of Life mean anything to you all, or the Jesus freaks? Okay, those are the early expressions of emergence Christianity in this country. The Vineyard Association is what emergence Christianity would look like if it could organize in the old way. A vineyard is nearer than anything else to what it would have been. It don't tell Vineyard that they're a denomination. They will kill you. They'll smack you upside the head. I don't know anybody. They do. They just get hysterical, you know. And it's like, you know. And they don't have bishops. They have overseers.
Exactly.
Oh, exactly. You know, exactly. What's
it's
the difference?
So funny.
Yeah, I know. One's in blue jeans, the other's in a coat. That's the only difference.
Yeah.
It's so weird. But they're what it would look like. Willow Creek megachurch, if that means anything, is an early expression of emergence Christianity. And they came along and tried. They weren't going to be a denomination. They're now an association. But anyway, they weren't. But they kept the old rules, and the result was it didn't work. And one of the most startling things to happen in recent time was 2 years ago, Lee Strobel and Bill Heibel said, this isn't working. And they trashed $14 million worth of programs in order to go further and become, frankly, emergence. And I've always admired those two gentlemen anyway, but my admiration went way up. That takes guts, you know, to just say, programs are a Protestant problem, and programs are a Protestant problem. You can't program an emergence service. You can't program an emergence. They just, you know, they slither away and leave you and stab them, and they're not having any of it. The first emergent church in this country that claims a history of it is Irving Bible Church in Irving, Texas. It was founded in 1969. It's now 22,000 members strong, which goes back to the fact that megachurch goes across all qualitative lines. It's a quantitative denominator. It has to do with size. This one is frankly emergence and says so, and it's huge. 22,000 members in Irving. It's the oldest one in this country. Founded in the same time, I guess 1970, I'm sorry, 1 year later, is St. Gregory of Nyssa in San Francisco. It's the first of the Anglo-Emergent churches. And we're going to talk about hyphenated very shortly, probably tomorrow, obviously. We're going to talk about hyphenated. That is, those who are by sensibility emergence, but who wish to keep the old forms. And so they're called hyphenated because they're Baptist emergence or meth emergence, which sounds like a bad drug, or Luther emergence or whatever. And I spoke of playfulness this morning. And I love the playfulness of emergence Christianity. It just doesn't take itself that seriously. And for a while we had age emergence for Assemblies of God and coach emergence for Church of God in Christ. They were the hyphenated. And all of the Pentecostals, not all of them, but a number of the Pentecostals got together not too long ago and decided they were tired of being that. They were going to all be submergence. And I love it. I just love it, you know. And that's what they refer to themselves as. There is a group of women across all denominations who are really fighting the Mark Driscoll part of the movement, and they've decided that they're all going to be convergence, and they're going to not belong to any group except to the cause. God help us with the cause. But anyway, so the scholarship. Has been around for quite a while. The first of it to actually appear, and when I went looking, the question Jan asked at the break was, how did you get in this mess, essentially? And I got in this mess because I was in the book industry. And the question suddenly in the 90s, early 90s, became, why do we now have religion bestsellers when we never had them before? Never before in American history had religion books been commercial bestsellers. Or what religion books were there didn't move in the normal commercial channels, or they were published by denominational publishing houses. And suddenly, big-time publishing is overwhelmed by all of this. And so the question became, why is it happening? And what do we buy in order to do it? Which meant that I had to go look for the scholarship for the first time. And the scholarship had been there for a very long time. It was just that there was no need to find it. But when the cash register begins to ding and dang, then there becomes a real impetus. So, as I told Jan, whatever else I am, I'm really a sociologist of religion as it's commercially applied, quite literally. But when you go looking for the scholarship, what you find is that as early as 1906, Walter Rauschenbusch wrote a book called Christianity in the Coming Social Crisis of the 21st Century. And the first 40 or 45 pages of that book are nothing in the world but reformation, which was what he was calling it, little r and with a hyphen, or sometimes reformation with a little r, that indeed it is upon us. And he was prescient enough to know it. That book was so significant, Harper was the publisher, that in 2006 they issued a centennial edition of that book, so you can get it in update. It was that significant. And so far as I know, Rauschenbusch was the first one to name the beast. By mid-century, Paul Tillich, and this is what Jan and I were talking about, Paul Tillich in his letters, not in his writings, but in his letters, there are two or three rare, and I couldn't even give you the date now, I have to really go research it. There are two or three references in the letters in which he says the ground is shifting. One of the things he says is the ground is shifting again. And one of which he says we're in it again, whatever it is. Or in a third place he says we're going into a certain medievalism again. And one of the characteristics of these upheavals is that every time we go through one, we go back 600 years to when things were just lovely and try to fake it. That is, of course, they weren't real lovely, but we think they were. And we think that if we could just get rid of the 500 years of interruption that were clearly unpleasant and wrong, and we could go back here, we would find the truth again. And so we have, in this culture, been going through a period of neo-medievalism for about 50 years now. Star Trek and Star Wars come out, or pseudo. A medievalist would never think it was medieval. It's pseudo or fob or whatever you want to call it, but it's an attempt to move back to that presumed tranquility of right before the Reformation. And so what you've got is Star Trek, Star Wars, Da Vinci Code comes out of that, goth clothing comes out of that, tattooing, not that the medievalists tattoo themselves, but it's seen as medieval, and Joan of Arcadia, the monks selling, chanting and selling IBM copiers and Pepsi Cola, if you remember that, all of those things, Angels and Demons works on it to some extent, certainly Harry Potter. Plays to a certain need to go back to what we perceive as the time. So Tillich refers to that. The first one who actually outlined what I'm about to put up and what we will be discussing for the first hour tomorrow was Walter Pannenberg, the German theologian. Pannenberg postulated and nobody, interestingly enough, we shut down a Virginia Theological Seminary about three summers ago. Diana Butler Bass did. She was on faculty at that point. Trying to find the footnote, trying to find the place where Pannenberg first says this. Only academics worry about things like that. But it was driving me crazy because I cannot find where Pannenberg first did it. I've always been told. I was told by Wade Clark Roof, who gave us Generation of... Generation of
X?
No.
Oh, you mean the book title?
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Okay, well, anyway. Wade Clark Roof, dissertation was Generation of Seekers. That's what I was trying to do. Wade Clark Roof's dissertation was accepted by VTS in 1969. And in that dissertation, he cites Pannenberg. And from a private conversation. So we know Pannenberg did it somewhere before 69. We just can't find where. And for a week in the summer, all the faculty pursued trying to find the original on this, if you can believe that. 12 good men and true, all trying to look, and we couldn't find it. which means that Wade Clark Wolf may be right. He may have drawn it on the back of an envelope. But once it got in his dissertation, then it was credited to Pottenberg and was accepted. What Pottenberg said was that by, and again, I'm going to restrict this to the United States. He was actually talking about Latin Christianity, please understand. He was speaking of the whole thing, but I'm going to talk in terms of the United States. That by the time we came to 2000, Christianity would be roughly divided into four equal sections. The first of which would be the liturgicals, by which he meant Roman Catholics and Anglicans and some confused Lutheran, of course, but basically, you know, there was no Greek Orthodoxy at that point in Western culture, so he didn't even. Now we would have to insert Greek Orthodoxy, which, as you know, is growing in this country. So, by the way, it's Coptic. And I'm sure you're aware of that. There's a huge growth. I mean, when you say there's a huge growth in the publishing of poetry, what you're really saying is that last year we had two books, and this year we have four books, you know, and that's 100% growth. So when you say Orthodoxy is blooming, you're saying now we've got six parishes where we had three. But nonetheless, it now is a factor to be dealt with. And what Pottenberg or Wade Clark Rook or whoever called mainline, and increasingly that term, I don't like that term, I've never liked that term, I don't know what it means, I think it carries a lot of baggage with it, but increasingly we're just calling it social justice Christians, which I know makes it look like a lot of Methodists, but you know, so be it.
We'll take you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you're gonna put denominational lines, it is Methodist and Presbyterian, you know, and the rest of the confused Lutheran, yada-dee-yada-dee, who belong there. And we're primarily talking about what would have been the old mainline. Down here, what Pottenberg or whoever called conservatives, and this one has had more names than I have underwear, to tell you the truth. It's been everything from fundamentalists to theocrats to, at one point, it was called Southern Baptist. It's gone. Evangelicals, everything. Ultimately, you get back to this is probably the best term for it. If it helps denominationally, what you've got is the Southern Baptist Convention. Yes, I admit that. American Baptists would be up here. Southern Baptists would probably be down here. It's not exactly fair, but it's close enough, to it. And evangelicals in general certainly belong to it. Those who are not necessarily members of a particular communion, but they belong in this category. And then over here, what is now called the Renewalists. One of the great blessings of the Pew Foundation, every once in a while Pew does something really wonderful, and one of the things Pew did was about 3 years ago come out with a report involving charismatics and Pentecostals. And this box used to be charismatic and Pentecostal. I used to stick them up here. And if you really want to annoy a charismatic, you put them in the same box with a Pentecostal, and conversely, a Pentecostal doesn't like to be in the same block with a charismatic. Now, some of you may be of those persuasions, and for the life of me, you can tell me the difference in the two, and I can remember until I get to the door, and then it kind of washes out of my head. It's that near to the same. I do understand some of the differences, but because there's such tension between the two groups, and basically, this box means to say those who depend on whose answer to the authority question lies within contact with the Spirit. And Pew came along and said, enough already. And they invented the word renewalist. And I don't think anybody remembers what the Pew Report was about, but every religionist I know remembers the word renewalist because we received it with such gratitude. Now we have a label that we can use. And so the renewalists are these folk. Pottenberg said that they will be roughly equal, and he's turned out to be very, very right. And what he said is that in each of these quadrants, if you will, and let me do it this way, in each of these quadrants, and in terms of the math, I years ago learned that you need to at least explain the graph a little bit. This is 100% of American religion by Pottenberg's scheme. This, therefore, is a quarter, more or less, of American religion. But each quarter also can be 100% of itself, all right? So 10% of this quarter right here, if you will, or 10% of a 25, whatever. Pottenberg said somewhere between 9 and 13%. It looks like to me within Anglicanism, and that's the one, of course, obviously that I'm most familiar with, it's going to be certainly in this country somewhere between 7 and 10%, though I really don't think we're going to go to 10%. What he said was, in each of these quadrants, there's going to be 10%, roughly, of that quadrant that is going to say, no, I don't want emergence, I don't want any part of it, what's happening is unholy and ungodly, and I have a godly need to oppose it. I have a vocation to, with every part of myself, resist the changes that are emergence Christianity, to resist the things that is making the pull toward the center, toward the merging, toward the emerging of Christianity into something else. I have a God-given obligation to not let it go there. In my communion, we call it Pittsburgh Bob, Bob, Bishop of Pittsburgh, Bob, but Bishop of Pittsburgh, Bob Duncan, or we call it Peter Akinola. Each of you has a different name in each of you. These are the human beings who say, no, I want it to stay the way it was because God made it that way. Any change in the institution is an unholiness. It is an evil thing, and I will oppose it.
I didn't know you knew that lady.
That's right. Yes.
It's right over there. That's 30.
Okay. All right.
I had a lady in my church that says, let me have it the way I've always had it until I die. After I die, you can do whatever you want.
Absolutely.
But she was dead within a year.
That was scary. A few funerals is going to help a lot of this.
Well, you pray for me. I got a couple of things I need.
Yeah, exactly. I totally believe you. Yeah. And you know, while they annoy the stew out of you, in many ways, they serve a godly purpose. Even as I get annoyed at Akinola, or get annoyed at Pittsburgh Bob, or get annoyed at Jack Schofield, or whoever, I also have to admit that a car on a wild careen down a steep hill will burn out its brakes and go, unless it's got good brakes. A boat on rocky water, unless it's got its ballast, will tip over. And in many ways, I'm pretty persuaded they do serve God with their resistance, as long as it's not selfishly driven, as long as it really is seen as a vocation, and they really do see it as a vocation. And there they are. Now, that they're back in their corners, and if you're doing the math, they're not more than about 2 or 3% of the whole picture, cumulatively put together. But they're there, and they're worth looking at. And now we're going to begin tomorrow to build what happens when this thing begins to squeeze out and we begin to get emergence Christianity out of this gathering center. And before we leave, I want to say one last thing. And if you'll bear with me before the clock will let you bear with me one more minute. And that is that when I do this, it is absolutely true that emergence Christianity is coming out of the melding of these four quarters. It's coming out of the center like this. There's no question that that's what it's being built out of. But that's not where the word emergence comes from. And this is the last thing I want to do about rhetoric or about vocabulary. And that is to say that emergence, and the reason we're calling both the cultural thing that I started with this morning, the great emergence, and we're calling this emergence Christianity, comes straight out of physical science. It is the sciences that have informed what we're going through, and they're informing this with the rhetoric. The term emergence comes out of biology originally, and it comes out of 19th century, mid to late 19th century biology, as we begin to understand ways that other than hierarchical to organize. And the first discovery was that an anthill and a beehive don't work the same way. Both have queens. There is a legitimate queen bee, and she legitimately runs the hive, and the hive works off of her. There is a queen ant who ain't good for nothing except having little baby eggs, who absolutely sends out nothing. An anthill, those great things that build like this, they all organize by emergence. That is to say, there is nobody in charge, ever. Ants talk to each other with pheromones. When an ant finds a piece of garbage that looks good, it lays down a pheromone that indicates there's food. and all of the other ants come and get it until there is no more food, and then they lay down pheromones. Feast is open. Nobody go there. Come eat. They all come and eat, and then they talk to each other with pheromones, saying, now take out the garbage. It's a constant thing in which the group self-organizes. Emergence Christianity, like emergence society, like emergence information, like emergence politics, self-organizes. It does not do this. It does this. And that's why we call it emergence. The next one that you probably find is slime mold. And slime mold is usually given, even by religionists, is the best example of what we're talking about when we're talking about emergence. And slime mold is not attractive. I don't know whether you have it down here in Florida, but those of you who live in different places, it looks like a dog threw up something on a log somewhere. It's slick and shiny, and sometimes has little yellow things in it. And it does. It looks like the dog threw up. And it's where there's moisture and where there's something for the slime to eat. Slime mold is made up of different organisms. There is no more than one cell in any integer. That is to say, it is a colony. It is not a thing. It is a community, or it is a polity, or whatever you want to call it. And when there is a discovery that there is moisture and something to eat, they all get together and they make that thing that you and I refer to as slime mold. They make that slick-looking thing. They look like they're a thing. And when they've eaten, they all go away. I don't know whether you've ever seen it, but they all go their separate ways. And there's no more slime mold until they find, it's a disgusting image, but it's the best example. It's the one that's used routinely. Until they find another feeding place, and they come together and make that thing that looks like it's something until they have eaten the food, and then they go away to their little individual selves. They are self-organizing colonies. They can, interestingly enough, we didn't know until the 60s, that slime mold can also move as a whole community. So that if the slime mold finds food here, and there's food 4 or 5 inches over there, they can, as a colony, go over here and eat instead of disbanding and reconfiguring later. That's emergence organization. It's completely contrary to everything that those of us who've been born since the Reformation understand as correct organization. But then we're not slime mold, fortunately. Emergence theory was also applied by Jane Jacob. Jacobs, the great urbanologist, sociology of urban living, who began to...
Is that M-O-L-E or M... What is it?
M-O-L-D.
What? M-O-L-D.
D. Oh, M-O-L-D.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It sometimes looks orange and it's always slick looking. It looks like saliva, where the dog... some of it does. It's very unpleasant looking stuff, but... It doesn't happen in San Diego. It won't happen in California. You have to be. It happens in Tennessee. I bet it happens in the woods in Louisiana, where you get it. But it's and it began to be a great interest to scientists to see how many things organized that way, as opposed to, we've always been so blind. It was top down and organized. Jane Jacobs then took it in the 50s into urban planning. It was she who went in and said, you can't level whole neighborhoods and do urban renewal. It won't work because the same thing will come back again because it's not anything. It's all of these things, and it self-organizes, and you can't do that. All you can do is begin to change each of the little pieces of it. And Jane Jacobs built her reputation and much of New York City and much of what New York is now on the realization that you could not come in from the top and level the place. You had to go in from the bottom and change the pieces and let it be an emergence form. And she spoke of emergence theory. So that's where the name came from. It's not, and I don't want to go into tomorrow having you think that it's because it's emerging out of the center. It happens to be an unfortunate fact that it is. But that's not why it's called emergence. And that certainly is not why the sociological construct is called the Great Emergence. It has to do with the way it organizes and sees itself as a self-organizing.
So are you hinting at the fact that there's a possibility that the church is no longer going to be run by political agendas?
I am suggesting wholeheartedly that would be true.
Let it be so.
Let it be so.
Please.
I am suggesting also that Protestantism, when it does reconfigure, and I meant it at lunch, it's clear that it's reconfiguring already, when it, in Wales, I didn't say this because I'm not sure it's true, but I was told by a Brit, whom I believe, that in Wales, the five state churches now share one building and one secretarial force. It's, and I've not had time to check it, but there was no reason for him to lie. Or to make it up. It's gone that far in Wales. Britain is about 20 to 25 years ahead of us, and the continent is about 10 years ahead of Britain in dealing with this. It came later to us. We were protected by the Pax Americana, the Golden Age of America, protected us in the middle part of the century from having this. But yes, if Protestantism is going to survive, it's going to have to find some way. It'll still organize from the top down. It's the only way it can. You can't have an Episcopal church without a bishop. You can't have a Methodist church without a supervisor. Or, you know, you just can't. But it's going to have to change in some way. An emergency ain't going to have any of the above. One of the funniest things that ever happened to me, I was with Tony Jones, who's the leader of the emergent part of this. We were in an Anglican church at the rector's request. The rector wanted to change some things to become Anglo-Emergent. And he asked us to come in and deliver the message, and I said it won't work. It absolutely won't work, and it didn't, because we were talking to people who didn't want to hear it, and that was why we were there, because the rector couldn't make them hear, you know, that thing. Bringing a different messenger, so when they don't like the message, they won't kill me, they'll kill the messenger. It got worse and worse and worse, and finally some dear lady in the back stood up and said, Mr. Jones, or Dr. Jones, am I to understand that you just don't like our having a gay bishop and that's what this is all about? And at that point, Tony had it. It was just up to here. I could see his face flushing, you know, 20 minutes before she got hold of it. And he said, Madam, I do not mind your having a gay bishop at all. It's just the fact that you have bishops in the first place that annoys the hell out of me. And we quit. We gave up and walked away, you know. Okay, you've been a great audience, and tomorrow we'll have a lot of give and take, I hope, as we begin to look at where the rubber hits the road and what this really means in terms of where you live and where I live and where God wants us to live.